Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, the podcast on all things coaching, brought to you by Animas. And now introducing your host, Yannick Jacob.
There we go. All right, Peter Hawkins, welcome to the podcast.
Lovely to see you again, Yannick. We've had this time to converse with you.
Indeed. Last time we met, I was in Acapulco. We were doing a little demo. We had a beautiful discussion afterwards. It was hot for me. Not the discussion, the climate, you know. Ooh. And there we're right in it, right? The climate is also pretty hot. But let's take two steps back. It is such an honor and a privilege to have you here. I get so much from our conversations. I really appreciate your output over the years. And by years, it stretches back to what, beyond the 80s. We had Robin Showett on the podcast, probably a little earlier. We had Robin.
So 1970s, when I was involved, and Robin Showett worked in the team, in my team as I was leading, running a therapeutic community. So we go back a long way. And so I think my first coaching was 78.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I feel very connected with that in some way, one way removed. My wife has been working in a halfway house when I met her, where people came from the therapeutic institutions, kind of trying to get back into life and, you know, cooking, cleaning, shopping, being together, but also delivering therapy. So we had a lot of interesting conversations. So when I heard about that and read about that, I felt very connected. And I'm sure it gave you lots. But since then, you had a illustrious career. You've written a lot. Most notably for me personally was systemic coaching and supervision in the helping professions. But there's a lot more publications that are really, really worth looking into. And just the way that you pack and frame complex ideas and transport them in a way that people can really engage with them. I just have a lot of appreciation and gratitude for the work that you're doing. You're chairman of Renewal Associates since I was 3 years old. So there's a lot of work there. You've done so much. I just wanted to give people a little bit of a taste for where you're coming from and what you're bringing. You're a global thought leader on systemic coaching, leadership coaching, team coaching. So there's a lot to you. Is there something that you would particularly highlight as something that perhaps might be important for people to know about you?
Well, I think, or perhaps I'll make it a story. When I got to my 60s and I'd sold my first consultancy, And you know, I always thought it was important if you were in leadership coaching, you also ought to take leadership. So, you know, I've been a CEO, I've chaired companies. But I got to 60 and I could have retired, you know, having sold the consultancy. And I've always asked this question, what can you uniquely do that the world of tomorrow needs? Mm. So I went off and did a retreat and I looked at, well, what could I do in my 60s? And I realized the world wasn't short of, you know, I've trained psychotherapists, coaches, supervisors, leaders. And I thought, well, actually, the world is not short of any of those. What the world is desperately short of is people who connect in-depth change at the personal level, the team of teams level. Mm-hmm. You know, the coach, the connections between teams, the organizational level, the organization and its stakeholders. And even more important, the human and the more than human world. Mm-hmm. And so throughout my 60s, which have ended, and I've done it, I've now got my, you know, what's my purpose for my 70s? It's been about how do we connect the best of organizational development, the best of therapy, the best of coaching, the best of understanding, how do we shift human consciousness? And then particularly, you know, in my 70s, I've become convinced that the whole of the ecological and climate crisis, which is the biggest challenge human beings are facing, at root, that is produced by the wrong way we think as human beings. Mm. And that without an enormous shift in human consciousness, we don't have, as Gregory Bateson said back in the 1960s, 70s, we do not have a snowball in hell's chance of surviving the next 100, 200 years. Mm-hmm. So for me, what is most critical now is for coaching, education, spirituality, strategy, organizational development, all of these fields to come together to realize we are all part of how do we mature human consciousness so that human beings are fit to be on this planet.
Yeah, talking about a systemic change that's needed when we change the way that we think as humankind. This morning I woke up and I wondered, how do I start this? What might be my first question to get into this? And as I was kind of having that in the back of my head, I had some breakfast, watched the news, and I heard about this terrible school shooting in Texas. And by the time this podcast gets released, or by the time you out there might listen to this, you might not even know which one, you know, and that's so tragic. It really got me. My little baby is 4 months old, 4 and a half now, and probably hit me more because I'm thinking about her going to school and I don't live in the States. There's like not no gun violence in the UK, but like there's no school shootings. I can't remember any. In Germany, I can't remember any. In America, it happens very, very regularly. And it, every time it happens, it shakes people and they think, well, how can we create systemic change with something that's so immediate? That's where the impact is so immediate to people, and there's outrage, and that is not even enough for systemic change to take place. So how the hell do we do that? And what is the role of coaching? What can coaches do who deeply care about these issues being faced with, usually trained as, well, this is client-led, you're supporting the client's agenda. But you think about these things from that perspective and you think, well, we need a change in thinking in this organization, in this family, in this person, in this society, as humankind. What a huge task. What would you say to that?
Well it's interesting because I did a book with my wife on integrative psychotherapy, trying to bring together all our years of training and working in that field as well as in coaching. And part of it, I try to address why is mental health becoming such a big issue and the growth of mental distress and disturbance. Mm-hmm. And it was quite an interesting inquiry and exploration. And one of the major things we looked at was how a lot of our traditional psychological holding structures and containers have got fragmented. So you have the fragmentation of the family, the community where we live. So people are nomadic. Mm-hmm. The fragmentation of shared belief systems. I grew up in an age where people still went to church and there was a rhythm to the week. So the fragmentation of the shape of the week, mm-hmm. where you know, you work 9 to 5 and you were home at the weekend and Sunday you went to church and the rhythm of the year. We've lost all those. And then I talked about the fact that we'd all become indigenous orphans. Mm-hmm. We're no longer rooted in place and rooted in the earth and rooted in our ecology. And you know, for the first time, I think about 10 years ago, more young men are dying from suicide than dying from all wars and murder put together. Mm-hmm. Right? So we hear about these moments of tragedy, but you know, every hour there are young people killing themselves. And that speaks to the disconnection of ourselves and family and community, the human family and the human in the more than human world. Mm-hmm. And then I talked about some other factors like the age of what I call the age of more.
Right? The age of more?
More.
More.
More want more. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The fact that with the internet, with media, the whole world knows what the richest are getting and want it, and the addictive society and rampant consumerism. And this is addictive. So the addictive society. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to go right down to, you know, just yes, America could do something about the gun laws, but actually, you know, interesting, why has football hooliganism started to rise up again? What is the, what's the need behind destructive behavior?
Mm-hmm. And can I jump in there briefly? Because I think it's quite important, because a lot of people think of this as, well, we need to do something about gun laws, right? We need to do something about the government intervening in this. And because, like, in other countries with a similar rise in disconnection and mental health issues, there isn't that kind of gun violence. So there could be something about government regulation that could solve some of this issue. But actually looking deeper, that only part of the issue is the lack of regulation and the lobbying. When you look deeper, there is something around the way that people think, the way that they are connected to their systems, that is much more difficult to tackle when already the government regulation seems impossible to tackle. And that's what makes me sometimes quite hopeless.
But you see, I think this is the human reaction when we have shocking tragedies like that, is that we go into a control response. Rather than how do we have wide-angle empathy, not just for the families who lost young children, children who've been traumatized and injured, the community that's in distress, but how do we also have empathy for that young 18-year-old who went and did the shooting? Mm-hmm. And how do we look at the need behind his need to go in, mm-hmm. which is something about young people who have no sense of meaning, purpose, or belonging. Yeah? That I feel so powerless, I feel so unseen, that the only way I can respond is to do something catastrophically dramatic. And that speaks to, I think, the how do we work? I was talking yesterday to the ICF Coaching Week in Kazakhstan about coaching in schools and colleges and university, and saying that actually coaching needs to totally transform from focusing on coaching individuals to coaching connections. And not just into personal connections, but how do we realize that I've written a lot about how partnerships are not created just by the partners, right? Whether it's a marriage, it's a team, or it's a merger. They are created by the collective purpose they can achieve together, they cannot achieve apart. So our team is the purpose that creates the team, not the team that creates the purpose. Yeah? It's the purpose that creates our belonging, that we've got something to achieve that we can't do by being apart.
And this is one of the questions that you always ask. I believe you always ask that, or at least probably most of the time, is that who or what does your work and your life serve? You know, what is the purpose of why you are working, why you're doing things? And then let that create what people are doing. It's such a powerful entry point. So when coaches feel this purpose, this drive to do something about these systemic issues, but they also want to be supporting their clients, like this is where the kind of seemingly conflict that I'm trying to explore, that I hear a lot from coaches and supervision, they say, well, I want to do something about it, but maybe my client doesn't want to do something about this.
So let's really focus there. Mm-hmm. There's two words, my client doesn't want to do something about this. Well, the two words I think we have to move beyond is client and want, right? You know, I had a CEO recently, and I actually said to him, I'm not interested in what you want. I'm interested in what's the work that is absolutely necessary for you and I to do together. I think we need to ban the word want from coaching.
Right. Because it points to the individual. Is that why?
But it not only points to the individual, but it activates the age of more.
Mm.
How do I make more progress? Right? How do I earn more? How do I have more impact? You know, it's ambition. It speaks to ambition and to greed. Mm. Right? And the word client takes us into I am the supplier, they are the customer. And it takes us into I do the coaching, which is an incredibly arrogant place. Mm. You know, I was at a meeting with Marshall Goldsmith's top 100 coaches, a big gathering. And they were discussing how they could have greater diversity and inclusion and who should they give the top 100 awards to in 2 years' time. And it was, you know, well, we need more people from different countries. In some ways, I sat there being worried. I thought this is a colonization, you know, how do we take the coaching flag and place it in new territories, right? And I said, but wait, you know, what about having the top 100 coaches? They do more than half the work, right? What about the top coaching projects, right? They transform a community or a country, like Ethical Coach has been doing in Ethiopia. You know, we're still stuck in an individualistic more mindset. So I say, look, don't call them the client, call them our coaching partner, right? Mm-hmm. And let's start in our very first meeting by connecting with them and making a heart connection. But then who and what does their life serve? What? Let's bring in all the people into the room that they are connected with in our imagination. You know, let's place them around the room, that their team, that their customers, their bosses, the teams upstream from them and downstream from them, their customers, their suppliers, communities where they operate. Mm-hmm. And I keep asking, and who else? And what else? What beyond your organization does your work and life serve? Mm-hmm. What beyond the human world does your work and life serve? And then when we've got all those different entities in the room, we can ask, right, let's ask them, what's the work you and I most need to do together? Mm-hmm. Let's discover from them. Right? Now we're into a very different constellation.
Mm-hmm. True partnership.
Because you and I are now shoulder to shoulder facing how life is knocking on the door, asking certain work to be done. Mm-hmm. And I'll start every supervision session not with what do you want from supervision. Again, that's customer, supplier, you know, what do you want? I'll say, what's the work that's most important for us to do today? Yeah. So we could start this conversation, we could start, what is the most important dialogue we need to have, mm-hmm. right? That the world of tomorrow needs us to be talking about today.
Yeah, and I heard you sum that up a couple of times as we are not coaching the client and we're not the ones doing the coaching.
Yeah. So, and this notion that we've got to be on the client's agenda, uh-huh. very strange notion that we've got stuck with. You know, we asked them, what do you want from coaching? Well, it's not a very helpful question because most coaches don't know what they need from coaching. Right? We have to discover together. And if we ask what do you want from coaching, we're if you like, we're evoking their left hemisphere neocortex and their egoic self.
Mm-hmm. Or they come into the coaching and they say what they want. And then how often does it happen? 3 sessions down the line, 3 minutes down the line, however long it takes, the goal changes. because it wasn't really what they wanted. Something more important has emerged here.
Or it's what they thought they're meant to say at the beginning of coaching relationship.
Uh-huh. That's right.
And we trigger that.
Yeah. Yeah. So how we ask that question, so important.
So Yannick, so I was mentioning to you, we just had this book coming out in October from Routledge called Ecological and Climate Conscious Coaching, mm-hmm. which I wrote with Alison Wybrow, who sadly mm-hmm. died while we were writing the book, yeah. and Eve Turner and Josie McLean, the three amazing women who started Climate Coaching Alliance, mm-hmm. which has grown very, very fast. Because mm-hmm. I think people are drawn to it because they realize this is overwhelming and we can only respond to it together mm-hmm. in community. So it's a very community-based organization. And as part of doing that book, we did some research and we sent out questionnaires. I think about 500 coaches altogether respond from right around the world. And the biggest concern came up: how do I address ecological issues if the client doesn't bring it up? Mm-hmm. And isn't that me bringing in my agenda? And this has come up on many talks I've given. You know, somebody said to me, it's not our job to bring the ecology into the coaching room. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's a very strange way of thinking. I said, you know, do your coaches eat? Do they breathe? I said, of course. I said, well, the ecology is already in the room. We're not, it's just that we're not paying attention to it. You see, we still have this very dangerous belief system that the ecology is out there. Mm-hmm. Oh, out the window, I can see it. I was on a whole panel podcast on coaching in nature, right? And halfway through, I said, look, I'm really worried about the assumption we have in this room that we're only coaching in nature if we go and take a walk in the park or in the wood, right?
Yeah.
Nature.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember having that insight at some point a number of years back when I realized this skyline right in front of me, all of these houses, that's nature. You know, I mean, it might be human built, but like that's all part of our ecology. It's all part of our world. It's not that this is the city and then this is nature. This is all nature.
So you're always coaching in nature. Mm-hmm. Wherever you know, the top of a tower block in Manhattan or in Canary Wharf or Beijing, you're still in nature.
And yet there seems to be something that connects us more profoundly when we are in what most people would call nature, when we're out in the woods or in the park. Not sure if that panel is connected to Fiona Parashar's book, The Positive Psychology in Nature. Exactly.
Beautiful way to coach. Yeah, and I've supervised Fiona for many years and wrote the foreword for her book. Yes, we do, because it is getting that connection back to the elements, to earth, to air, to water, to fire, yeah, which we need for our health. We need to build that. But you see, there are many ways we can do that. There's a lovely practice which I teach called Back to Source, mm-hmm. which, you know, you have lunch in the canteen in a big tower block, you take your food, you put it on the table, and you look at the food and you think and give thanks to all those who cooked it. Mm-hmm. And then you go back to all those who shopped for it, those who sold it, the transport that brought it to that supermarket, the markets it came from, farmers who grew it, the soil it grew in, the worms who made the soil, the rain that fell on the earth, the sun that right? And you just follow that food all the way back. In that moment, right? For that one moment, you are no longer an Indigenous orphan.
You create perspective.
You are connected back to source, back to source.
Yeah, I heard you talk about another exercise, if we can do that, a perspective shift where you place the client in within seven generations, forth and back.
Yes. So, well, there's a lovely one. There's a version of it in this, another lovely book, Roman Krasnarik's The Good Ancestor. How to think long-term in a short-term world. And this is so important. So we talk about how do we coach outside in, bringing all their connected worlds into the coaching and future back. There's a lovely practice. We have it in the book, Ecological and Climate Conscious Coaching, where you stand with the client and you ask them to center themselves now, and then to step back, to think of somebody who was really important to you, Yannick. You can do it right now. Somebody who was really important to you when you were 4 or 5 years old, grandparent, a relative, a friend. Can you think of someone? Who would it be? Yeah. Who would it be?
When I was 4 or 5 years old, I'd say my grandmother comes to my mind first.
Right. So now I would, if you were standing, I'd ask you to take one step back and picture your grandmother when she was the age you are now. Mm. What was her life like? Yeah. And where she was and who she was connected to. Mm-hmm. And then I'd ask you to take a second step back. Picture your grandmother when she was five, perhaps her 5-year-old birthday party. Mm-hmm. Where was she? Where was she living? Brothers, sisters, her parents, and it's a 5-year-old birthday party.
Yeah. I can picture that far, but I don't think I've ever went further back.
Right. So we'll pause there. Then I'll ask you to come back to now with that memory of connection to your grandmother and her 5-year-old and perhaps her parents. Come to now. Then I'll say, right, now I want you to take a step forward and I'll skip that step and go. The second step forward, I want you to imagine your I miss an important step. Come back to the place you started from and think of someone who's, I think you have a child who's four
months. Very little, yes.
So I would say, picture, what's her or his name?
Leah.
Leah, lovely. So I would take a step forward and think of Leah as her 5-year-old birthday party. Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
Right. Now I want you to take a step forward. Imagine that it is her 90th birthday. And at her 90th birthday, they're singing to her, celebrating her. And they ask her to give a speech. And just as she's about to give a speech, she takes a picture of you from the mantelpiece. And she talks about the difference you made to her life. And I want you to tell me what she is saying.
Mm. Don't let me get into it because I will cry.
And what is the most important thing that you taught her? Mm-hmm. And what's the most important way of connecting she learned from you? Mm-hmm. Now you see we're working future back.
Future back. Mm. And do you do that in your coaching? Like I try to make this very, very tangible, right? So coaches out there know how to work with this. Is this something you would do in the beginning of a coaching to kind of set it up, or before you decide to partner with someone? Or how does that show up?
Yes and yes. So let me give you two examples. Often in our first contracting meetings, and even in when I bring in the person's boss, HR, which is multi-stakeholder contracting, I might ask, what do you think in 2, 3, or 5 years' time from now, each of you will regret that we didn't use this coaching time for? What's going to come as a surprise to you in 5 years' time? You're already half now. I'll give you another example, because I teach systemic team coaching all around the world. One of people who trained with me, I'm supervising in Montreal in Canada, working with a large engineering company. The biggest shift working with the leadership team of this large engineering company was they invited every member of the team to talk as their grandchildren about what this company that their grandparent did, worked for, did, difference it made. And within half an hour, these very macho senior engineering leaders, several of them were in tears. And at the end, several said, we've worked with each other for 20 years, and I've discovered things about you I never knew. Because we brought the voice of the grandchildren into the executive C-suite room.
Can I ask a question about that? Because when I when I imagine that, I imagine that to have worked splendidly, but I also thinking, well, there must have been times where either the people weren't up for going there, or maybe they didn't care so much, or maybe they didn't want to open that door because that would mean they would need to make different decisions that would make them less money. It's not always the case. You know, I think you can combine these things, but like I would imagine that there would be plenty of times where the partners that you want to partner with were not really up for taking the steps, that they just would just build an inner conflict. And their hands would be tied by the stakeholders or the board.
But now you see, thank you, Yannick. You've created another very common dynamic that happens in supervision and in coaching. And that is, we blame the client. They were not ready. They weren't up for it, right? One of the most common things that happens in supervision, people come and say, oh, we had a great session. They had an aha, they went away with an action plan. And they'll say, but the problem is they didn't follow through. The second thing the coach says is, clearly they weren't committed, or they lacked the courage, or, right, they blamed the client. I said, stop. What would have had to have changed in the coaching for that not to have happened? And people say, but you know, my client wouldn't be up for this. You know, they only care about that. I say, listen, if they know that you're not doing it to be clever, you're doing it because you are committed to their fulfilling their potential and their success. And if you do it and you ask them from your heart, they're not resistant. So I say there's no such thing as resistance. Right? In the client resistance, there's only somebody else's energy flowing in a different direction than yours. So all you have to do is connect your energy with where the flow of your river with the flow of their river. If you could do that, you know, I've done things with besuited male boards of finance institutions which people say, oh, you'll never get them to do that. But yeah, if you're not doing it to be clever, but you're doing it, and they can see you're doing it because it's purpose-led, right?
But doesn't that imply-
it's led because there's a real need out there in the world.
But doesn't that imply that there's one purpose? Because I can imagine a person that, well, I've met a person actually that just didn't care about future generations because they never wanted to have children. They were quite the hedonist in terms of their life philosophy. And I challenged them and I was curious and we had a long conversation. It was difficult to find an inconsistency in the way that they lived. I disagreed with their values and their purpose, but it was consistent within how they lived their lives.
So just take that example. If we say one of the biggest problems is this split between the human and the more than human world, that is rooted in the fact that we think that we can have a fulfilled life by exploiting the world around us. But the fundamental of ecology and evolution, you see, we've misunderstood Darwin. Mm-hmm. We've translated Darwin as, you know, the survival of the fittest is the survival of the strongest and the most selfish. Yeah, Richard Dawkins and the selfish gene. Actually, it's a total misunderstanding. What Darwin was talking about is about the co-creation with our ecological niche, our ability, the right fitting, right? It's not fit because it's always in dynamic change. Anyone, to meet your own needs, you have to serve your ecological niche. If you destroy your ecological niche, you destroy yourself, as we are in the process of doing right at the moment, right around the world.
Yeah, I think the problem is it's too far in the future for people to take action on this if they don't think beyond their generation.
Yes, but then that's our job as educators, coaches, therapists, or whatever, is to bring the future into the room, to bring the outside into the room, so it is tangible.
Right, so once
in very practical ways, in very practical ways, we've got to get, people don't change through being told things.
They don't change through intellectual awareness. They need to get an experience through, for example, those exercises to really imagine that you're there, to create that connection in a way that's so strong that they don't feel they have any other choice but to do the right thing. And I'm saying that in quotation marks because for me it's still an assumption. I believe in it, but I'm not sure whether everybody will arrive at that same conclusion even though they experience that kind of connection. That's why I'm not sure still.
Well let me offer you a reframe, because I could join you in saying we haven't yet found ways of helping some people arrive there. We haven't yet found some, because then that puts it back on us rather than making them the blockage.
Yeah. How can I engage this person in a way that they get it, which still claims that we have found the right answer and the right thing to do here, which again, I agree with. But it's not about us, you say.
It can't be an it. Get it.
Ah.
How can we engage with generous, wide-angled empathy for this person and the whole interconnected world they are part of? How can we lovingly hold those two and find and discover? It's not an it we want to get them to, but discover and learn fast about how to create that connection. You see, I think we over-rely on a lot of coaching over-relies on change somehow happening in the neocortex. Yeah, and the reason why people leave with action plans that don't get followed through is we make the action plans here, but change is always embodied.
Mm.
Yeah. So I always say, if the change doesn't happen in the coaching room, it ain't gonna happen outside it, because you somehow come up with an intellectual action plan. So I'm very interested. The other thing is, if we look at all the stuff on vertical development, I don't think people move from one level of consciousness to another through being taught it. So people who were very much in a technician expert mindset would say to me, what's the seven things I need to do to be an achiever leader? I'll say, well, the first one is to stop asking that question.
Yeah.
Achievers don't ask that question.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to help people. We have to help people have experiences that confound their current way of being.
Mm-hmm.
Something they want to succeed at that they cannot do within their own way of operating. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
A practical example, we worked with senior partners. I've worked with senior partners in most of the big four professional services firms. And we devised a training, and we said, look, you cannot come on this training unless you bring with you, right, I don't mean literally, but you bring with you two relationships, one internal, one external, that you want to transform as part of this course, that are commercially important to your organization.
Mm-hmm.
So now they couldn't say this is a HR people thing, you know, nice to have, but it had to be commercially important. But it was a compulsory course. They had to go on it, but we wouldn't let them on it until they'd,
mm-hmm.
they'd done that work. And when they were on it, we put them in groups of six, seven, eight people with a facilitator, where they had to bring that relationship and be coached by one of their peers. We taught the rest of the group models by which they would map what was going on between the two people in front of them. We told them they had 40 minutes to transform how that person was thinking, feeling, and connecting with the relationship they had brought to explore. So then what we would do is we'd call timeouts every so often. So that person would be going through it, and so I'd call a timeout and say, look, you know, we've been, because we mix them up. We put them in different technical groups, were all mixed up, different regions and countries were all mixed up. So they didn't know the background of each other's issues. They couldn't solve it technically.
Yeah.
And I would say, but you have, you know, he's been telling you all about this and you haven't said anything. And we're a quarter of an hour in. And the person said, well, I've got nothing to offer. I said, why not? He said, I don't know what the problem is yet. And then, so you catch the mindset in action, which is I can only solve problems for people.
Yeah, well, that's how most of business works, unfortunately.
And then we went on a bit further with another person, and they'd come up with a, you know, sort of, they'd been thinking through, but there'd be no energetic shift in the room, and they just got a sort of idea of what, oh, that's a good idea, yeah, I'll probably do that. So I said, right, time out. On a scale of 0 to 10, how confident are you that this is going to transform that relationship? He said, well, it may do. I said, well, give me a score. He said, four, five. I said, right, this is just for the coach.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't talk to the coachee.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you've got 5 minutes to take that score from 4 out of 10 to 8 or 9 out of 10. Starting now. Within 2 minutes, he called a timeout and he asked his colleagues for help. That was the change. Right? So now you put them into a paradoxical situation whereby that they want to be get grade A's, you know, all their lives they've been grade A people.
Mm-hmm.
They want their fellow partners to see them as a successful transformational coach.
Mm-hmm.
But they cannot do it in their current way of thinking.
Yeah. So they have to get other people involved.
So they have to ask for help, and then you've got to create that learning hunger, that yeah, you've got to take them to a learning edge.
Mm-hmm.
Where they don't have the answer, you don't have the answer, but there's no denial that a new answer is needed.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the important work's done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So who comes in and sets that agenda for us? Because here it was very clear.
Life sets the agenda competently. You know, people say, you know, we did some research with senior clients of coaching, and they all of them said, we want our coaches to challenge us more. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we've been trained. We should, the client has the answer.
We stay neutral.
We stay neutral. This is a lovely strange belief system that, or we park our experience outside the door. You know, that's always bothered me. Mm-hmm. How can you take your experience out of you and park it? Mm-hmm. There are some truths within those ideas, but I always say we shouldn't challenge from knowing better or knowing first. But we should bring all our experience to the party. And that means that not knowing better or knowing first, we have to walk with them to the Ling Edge where they don't have the answer, we don't have the answer.
We might know different things, and we might be the voice of, oh, that's super interesting, you know, because it seems different to what I thought I know. How do we make sense of that? It's not I'm better or I know more. It's, oh, that's interesting. There is something here. How do we make sense of this together?
And what we do bring is two things. What one is that we are not within their culture and their immediate drama. We have the privilege of being an outsider, mm-hmm, to a certain extent. And the second is, the longer we go on, we have seen similar kind of patterns and processes that we can draw upon. Mm-hmm. Those are the two privileges that we can bring to the party. Mm-hmm. But at that moment at the Learning Edge, we have to have the humility and the courage to hold them there, right? To do the hard work at that Learning Edge where life is requiring a new response. Mm-hmm. As it is in Texas this morning with the shooting, right? That's a Learning Edge. And we mustn't jump to easy solutions. Yeah. COVID comes as a teacher. Hmm. But are we learning the lessons? Hmm. The war in Ukraine comes as a teacher, but are we learning the lessons? The fact that there are 50-degree temperatures in India, places are becoming unlivable and islands are going underwater. Life is teaching us, bringing us lessons, but are we just running to easy solutions or shutting our eyes with willful blindness, or are we standing at that learning edge?
Yeah, and sometimes the easy solutions seem impossible, you know, in terms of thinking back to gun laws. I mean, climate change is so much more complex than that even. I feel inspired by, we haven't quite yet found a way to engage who we need to engage. When we take that into the context of coaching, can you tell us about a time when you initially failed to engage an individual or a group of people that you were coaching, and then in hindsight, or perhaps later on in the coaching process, you found a way to engage them where you felt that, you know, what we might label resistance. And then you did find a way to, I don't know, get through, to have them resonate with something, and it did finally change.
I'm just trying to think of what would be a good example. That might relate to the people listening. You see, I do a lot of work with senior teams, and one major organization I worked with, we did a fantastic piece of culture change, and I coached the top team and got all onto the same agenda, and they got so engaged, but they were totally, they were disconnected with their board, and the leader was he saw the board as something to be controlled and managed, you know, kept at arm's length. And I knew that he was building his own demise because this would come back and bite him. Mm-hmm. But I left it too late in the process to challenge him about this. Yeah. And fantastic culture change, much of which got undermined because there was a falling out with the board, and the chairman and the CEO were both removed. What I learned from that is I can't leave it beyond my very first meeting to bring the important bits of the outside in. So if I work with a top team now, I actually make it a condition that they allow me to go. I'm working with a big global company at the moment. And I said, look, they asked me, would I coach their top team? I said to the HR director and the CEO, I said, yes, but maybe. I never say yes or no. I say maybe. I've worked with you. I said, but let me go and talk to the two of you, and let me go and talk to a member of your board. Let me go and talk to somebody who reports to your team, so I can get an understanding of the whole dance. Mm-hmm. And it, oh, well, you know, not sure. I think if you go and talk to the chairman, we ought to be there. I said, no, if we're going to work together, you need to trust that I can go and talk, and I'm not going to talk about you. Because if you can't trust me to go and talk to your chairman and just in an inquiry, an open way, then perhaps we haven't got the foundation we need for a coaching relationship. Mm-hmm. And that way, I am making it clear from the word go that I am here not just to have private conversations with you, I am here to coach the connections up, down, across. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And I learned that the hard way. But by seeing, you know, being able to coach teams and see what happened 2 years after I'd stopped working with them.
Yeah.
And always to ask the question, so what did I fail to do? Not blaming them. Mm-hmm. What did I fail to do in that process that could have made a difference?
That's taking a lot of responsibility, because I see a number of coaches in supervision that always go to themselves first, and it actually, not sure if that's productive, because we still share responsibility of whatever change we're trying to make in the world, whatever we feel called to create here in this partnership. I mean, it's a partnership, right? So when you say it's never the client, we haven't found a way to engage them.
I didn't say that. I said it always starts with,
okay.
In supervision, the only thing we can shift in supervision is that which is in the room.
Right. Yeah. That makes a lot more sense.
So it's supervisor. What do I have to shift inside me?
Yeah.
Connect inside me to connect my relationship with the supervisee, for the supervisee to connect something inside themselves that shifts the relationship with their client, which helps shift something in their client, in the coachee, which shifts something in their relationship to the world. Yeah. It doesn't mean I am response able, not I am the one who it's all down to me.
I think
that's arrogance.
It's really important to clarify, because otherwise we're going to create a lot of guilt in a generation of coaches that, you know, have understood and experienced that we need to do something about this, but maybe they have not found a way to engage this person, or this person just did not want to engage.
You see, I see there's no such thing as a resistant coachee or resistant customer or impossible boss. There's only a mode of engagement we have not yet found.
Right. So it is on the coach to find a way to engage them, and that's always possible.
No, it is down to us to ask the question, what is the engagement that's needed? And actually the answer may be, well, actually the engagement that's needed is not with me.
Uh-huh. Right.
You know, Alcoholics Anonymous say they don't help an alcoholic on the way down. They have to reach rock bottom. Mm. Right. To be ready, because otherwise they go through this cycle of, I'm going to crack it. And then they binge, and then I'm going to, and that whole cycle. So, you know, so, but I think I don't like the phrase coach is client readiness. I have this, one of the biggest problems is we personalize everything, and it's happening right now in the conversation, is either the client's responsibility or the coach's responsibility. Always I say, locate the challenge. Turn the problem into a challenge and locate the challenge in a connection. So we can say, myself and this coachee haven't got the capacity at this moment to do the work that's needed.
I think that's great. That leads me into a question I wanted to ask for a little while, because a lot of the people listening to the podcast right now or watching it, they're going to be at the start of their coaching journey, or maybe a little while in. And what I found talking to a lot of coaches is that the systemic lens seems to come in with a certain level of maturity as a coach. Your colleague David Clutterbuck talked about this. I know some coaches from the very beginning add the systemic lens in, but there's a lot to hold there. It can be quite complex engagements. So I wonder if somebody's listening to this or watching this, and they are at that stage of their coaching journey where they are focusing on the individual, because that's what most coaching schools teach. Is there a place for that kind of approach to help the, you know, to help the climate crisis, to help create that sort of shift? Or do we need to add a systemic lens in order to be able to do this sort of work?
So, I think David Clutterbuck's a good friend and colleague. And I think we shouldn't fall into the trap of saying, you know, systemic is something you reach after 10 years or 20 years of coaching. I don't think we can afford to do that any longer. I think that with your 4-month Leah, right, there is a way that when we are 2, 3, we actually are naturally systemic, and we are naturally going to the learning edge every moment of every day. Then it gets schooled out of us. And I have a project at the moment we're looking at with Salome van Collier, who's professor of coaching at Stellenbosch University in South Africa. She's coming to spend her sabbatical working with my mentoring. And we're looking at what is ecological curricula that can be built into every coach training. And we talk about this in the book. So in the book I've done with Alison Weibrauer and Eva Turner and Joseph McLean, ecological and climate conscious coaching, we do have all sorts of stuff that you can run as your own peer group, that you could run on a basic coach training. And it includes every day, it's written as though it's a 7-day workshop. Each chapter is a half a day. It has contributions from 60 different coaches and leaders from around the world. So each half day, different voices are brought in. There's a facilitator who's facilitating the workshop. And then there are exercises you can go and do. to name one, which you can download and do straight away, which is called www.deeptimewalk.org. You download the app, you put it on your mobile phone, you go for a walk, which each pace of this walk is a certain length, it's 1,000 years of Earth's history. And you play this whole play where you hear the sound effects of the formation of the Earth, the meteor tilting the axis, you start to get it through your body. You start to experience the very small part you are in Earth's history. You know, you've walked for several kilometers. We're just getting to the beginning of animals. And, you know, you go another couple of kilometers, you realize right at the end, you know, this is human history. And we need that sort of education. And a colleague of mine has taken this and done it with troubled adolescents in a big urban setting and taken them on this walk with the headphones and listening to it. And it's transformative. So I think we have to discover all sorts of ways that, you know, we don't say, well, you know, start off by coaching the individuals and then 10 years later, we'll help you unlearn all of that. Because actually we've just increased the amount we have to unlearn.
And
right from the word go, we have to realize that the coach. And so I teach very practical things. Yeah. Right with first level coaches. How do we meet each other and ask, you know, lovely exercise we could have done today. I could have said, Yannick, you've got 2 minutes to tell me the story of your life from the moment you were born to sitting here right now that's led to this moment right now.
Wow, 2 minutes.
In 2 minutes.
Yeah, you have to pick out the most important parts.
It connects your birth to now.
Wow. Well, I'm sure that makes people stop and think.
Yeah. And then I can say, so Yannick, tell me in your life. Let me ask you this question. We'll do it live. Yannick, when in your life do you feel, in your work, in your life, do you feel most alive and most connected to the whole world?
When I'm in deep connection with someone around something that's purposeful and it feels bigger than the two of us.
And then if I was coaching you, I'd say, so tell me the last moment that happened.
Now.
Right. So how do we ensure, you and I, that we keep that connection? What's the purpose you and I most need to be addressing that you don't have the answer for and I don't have the answer for? That's really, now that doesn't take 20 years of coaching to get to. We can teach that from day one.
And
let me say one other thing. The biggest trap, in another trap that happens in organizations is when we bring all the stakeholders in, they go into overwhelm. And why do they go into overwhelm when they've got to think about, you know, investors, customers, employees, suppliers, communities where we operate, the more than human world, everything that's coming over the horizon? Because they see all of those things as demands and separate demands, and they get overwhelmed. So they say, HR, you look after the people, and sales, you look after the customers, and finance, and then we disaggregate the whole ecology. That doesn't work. Only when we can get them to realize that every one of those stakeholders is also a resource. Right? The ecology is not a problem out there. Human beings to sort out. Right? It's been there millennia, millions, billions of years before we've been here.
Yeah.
And we'll be afterwards. And it provides 99% of what sustains our lives. So why do we not see it as this enormous resource, this enormous, not resource for us to exploit, but that which is blessing us every moment of every day? Why don't we see our customers as a fantastic resource? And the Chinese company I went to visit, where all their sales is done by their customers, not by the sales force.
Yeah.
And the R&D in that company is done by having competitions, tapping into the unutilized cognitive capacity of the world. Yes, we just have to. There's this lovely line I often quote from the Sufi poet Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi. Why, in the plenitude, that the richness of God's universe, have you chosen to fall asleep in such a small, dark prison? We don't have to have the answers, but we have to help people break out of their prisons, you know, put windows into the walls, get some air in, open the door, let in the richness of the world that they're connected to.
Yeah.
Stop trying to work it all out in your head.
Yeah, and if that's happening in an experiential way, you mentioned transformative and transform. I think there's some experience that we have that it's difficult not to transform after we've experienced that. And there can be lots of different experiences. And sometimes it's happening when we sit with a coach and they're asking us those kind of questions or inviting us or guiding us through exercises or through thought experiments or through visualizations that connect us in this way.
Or just having lots of empty chairs and bringing in the different, you know, your family, your boss, your team, and having people get the coach go and sit in those chairs.
Yeah, that makes it an experience.
I do encourage you. What a rich and blessed work we have.
Yeah.
And how do we leave every coaching session feeling we've learned something? And we've been at that learning edge with them.
I'm having an eye on the time. I wonder, where would you recommend or where would you point coaches to who are listening to this and they want to learn more? How does it look like in practice? I think we touched on a couple of examples, but I know there's so much more. You mentioned a book coming out in October. We put a link if it's ready for pre-order already. Systemic coaching has quite a bit of very practical stuff in there. Where would you point people to?
If you're doing individual coaching, systemic coaching, the subtitle, very importantly, is delivering value beyond the individual, which I wrote with Eve Turner, also from Routledge. If you're interested in the whole world of systemic team coaching, this book, Leadership Team Coaching, now in its fourth edition, that helps look at how we coach leadership teams and all teams, project teams. So if anybody's listening who is a team leader, how do you make the team more than the sum of its parts? Mm. And how do you coach not just the relationships in the team, but between the team and all the stakeholders that team serves? Because it's the same processes. Mm-hmm. Who does the team serve?
Yeah.
Who are the people it co-creates value with and for?
So different contexts.
Always coach the connections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so different contexts, but same principles that are at work.
Absolutely.
So depending in which context you're in as a coach, if you want to work in this way, there are plenty of resources you can go to learn more. And it is a journey.
And we also, in both books, provide a number of practices you can do, because it's not just what we learn in the coaching course. It's practices you do, like the one I mentioned, that everyone listening can do with their meal this evening. Mm. Yeah. It's the practice I often teach around watching the news with wide-angled empathy. You know, how long can you go having compassion for the children who got shot, their parents, the police who came in, the person who did the shooting, the family of the shooter? How long can we go with compassion, non-judgment about everyone who's on the news?
Mm-hmm.
Vladimir Putin and soldiers and the people being shot in. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we so easily take sides.
Yeah, yeah. Peter Hawkins, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Any last words?
Well, thank you for sharing this time with me and for inviting me for the third time. We have done a project together.
Mm-hmm. I hope we got a few more times.
Me too. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Coaching Uncaged. If you want to find out more about becoming a coach, developing your coaching skills further, or training as a coaching supervisor, then head along to animascoaching.com. Thanks again and catch you on the next episode.